Hello, Mr. Chomsky. Pleasure to meet you. Just a few quick words, be very concise. And your talks on democracy, I feel, are very relevant when one looks at the current conditions of democracy and its major socio-economic institution. There has been some unrest, which has resulted in an industrial action from staff and several public protests from the students, calling for more transparency and accountability in the structures of UCBSE administration. With this, we have had increasing onus placed on OECD and WAG reports, which would be that of a corporate thinking, that of a right-wing corporate thinking and a distress. Just in general, how do you think us as major shareholders, if I include staff and students, how to fight and get democracy back into our institution, which you may add has a major influence in the sphere of civil society? Thanks very much.
Bravo! Amen!
But in general, yeah, sure, it should be done. Every institution should be run by its participants. That's what democracy means. That's why democracy has always meant anyone who cared about it, workers' control of production, participant control of every other institution, democratic control of communities interacting with one another. That's democracy. Should hold for universities. There are what are called stakeholders, anybody who's interested, who's concerned by their operations and the effect, and yes, they should have, they should make the decisions, whatever mechanisms are used, that has to be worked out in particular cases. But the principle, I think, ought to be pretty clear.
I'm wondering what your analysis is of the more recent events, the nuclear program in Iran, and is this just simply saber rattling, or is this the preparing the public mind for the next war in the region? And you know, I find it hard to believe that this administration will take on another war, but then again, maybe they have achieved their objectives in this war, which is the devastation and control of Iraq, and maybe that would be sufficient for the next phase of the next war, and so on.
Just before coming at home, I never watch television news. I can't subject myself to great pain. But when I travel, I do it, since I don't get newspapers. And just before coming here, I happened to look at, was watching CNN for a couple of minutes, their evening news. And they had the impassioned discussions of this topic, which were quite interesting for what they ignored and falsified. So, for example, there was a segment about 6:30 or so, maybe you saw it, on the precedent for bombing of Iranian nuclear facilities. The precedent was Israel's bombing of the Oserak reactor in Iraq in 1981. And the commentator opened by saying it was certain that this bombing stopped Iraq's nuclear weapons program. And then they went on to interview various Israeli commanders and pilots who had participated in it. One of the omissions is that they did not interview the chair of Harvard University's physics department, a specialist on nuclear energy, nuclear weapons production. He happened to investigate the Oserak reactor immediately after the bombing. And he published a report on it in the most prestigious international scientific weekly, Nature, so nobody could have missed it. And in the report, he said that he had investigated the reactor and it simply was not designed to be able to produce nuclear weapons. It was designed to produce nuclear energy. That conclusion was then confirmed by Iraqi defectors in later years, nuclear scientists who had been compelled by Saddam to work on nuclear weapons, and they made the same points. Wrote memoirs, articles saying, yes, after the Israeli bombing, Saddam ordered them to start a nuclear weapons program for pretty clear reasons. If you're going to be bombed, you need a deterrent. As far as anybody knows, that's what happened in 1981. But it's not the required story. The required story is the one that you're hearing day after day. Okay, and it could very well be the same in Iran. There are many, and no sane person wants Iran to have nuclear weapons. We can agree with that. On the other hand, if they're not developing nuclear weapons, well, to quote one of Israel's leading military historians, so if they're not developing nuclear weapons, they are crazy. Simply look at the conditions in which they live. They're surrounded on both sides by a hostile, violent nuclear. The U.S. Has just informed them, instructed them, that they better build nuclear weapons. The invasion of Iraq was understood everywhere outside the civilized West, and even among strategic analysts in the West, as simply telling people, if you want to protect yourselves from attack, you better have a deterrent. And there are only two deterrents, nuclear weapons and terror. So therefore, as anticipated, the invasion of Iraq has led to proliferation of nuclear weapons proliferation and sharp increase in terror, as anticipated, and it is logical. So if you want to stop, this is quite apart from the fact that they're also threatened by the regional nuclear power, Israel, small country, but it's an offshoot of the United States, which means a huge military force, has air and armored forces greater than any NATO power, larger, technologically more advanced. And the U.S. has just, in the last couple of years, made it very clear to Iran that they'd better develop a nuclear deterrent. The last couple of years, the United States has been sending Israel over 100 of its most advanced jet bombers, which are publicly advertised, as very publicly, as being capable of flying to Iran and returning. They're also providing them with what they call secret, a special weaponry. Nobody knows what that is, but it's designed for the ears of Iranian intelligence. So they'll assume the war must make a worst case analysis. So the U.S. is basically telling them, you had better develop nuclear weapons or you're in trouble. And maybe they're doing it, maybe not. As far as we know, what they are doing happens to be within the framework of the Non-Proliferation Treaty. Not only that, but the actions they are now carrying out are those that the United States wanted them to carry out and helped them carry out up until 1979. Up until 1979, when Iran was ruled by the vicious dictator that the US and Britain installed in 1953 when they destroyed the Iranian parliamentary system. Up until then, the United States was encouraging Iran to develop nuclear energy. In fact, my own university, MIT, had programs, surely with government support, probably with government initiative, to train, bring over Iranian engineers, train them in the nuclear energy development, send them back to Iran. It caused a huge scandal on campus. Students were overwhelmingly opposed. This relates to the last question. Students were about 80% opposed, but sort of was rammed through by the administration and faculty. Well, that was before the overthrow of the Shah. Now, the very same programs are being condemned. And in fact, you know, here I think they probably should be condemned. Production of nuclear, of fissionable material that can be used for nuclear weapons should be under international control. That, in fact, is virtually a necessity for human survival. And there are proposals as to how to do it, but they're dead in the water because the U.S. won't allow them. There was a major vote of the United Nations on this last November, which was not reported in the United States, and I'm willing to make a bet it wasn't reported here, but you can tell me, probably the most important vote in the history of the United Nations, November 2004, on what's called a fissile material cutoff treaty, a treaty that would ban production of weapons-grade fissionable materials, or place them under some international supervision. The vote on that was 147-1. Guess which one? Two countries abstained. The one in Israel, which reflects it, it has to go along with the United States. And the other was Britain. The British ambassador explained his vote at the United Nations. Should have been headlines all over the British press and the world press. He said Britain agreed with the ban, but this particular formulation of it, he said, was too divisive. It divided the world 147-1. I could go on, but these are the real issues. And yes, we don't want Iran to have nuclear weapons. And there's a way to reduce the probability. One, stop compelling them to have nuclear weapons by threatening them, by making it very clear you want to attack them, and by telling credible lies about what happened with the Iraq reactor, and in every possible way making them somehow feel they have to get nuclear weapons so they'll be destroyed. That's one thing you can do. The other is to take the non-proliferation treaty seriously. The worst violators are the nuclear powers, far in ahead, and the lead is the United States. And yes, that should be taken seriously. In fact, the fate of the species depends on it in this case. It's not a mild move. We'll talk about this in a couple of days in another talk. But this is not a small point. Yeah, that can be done. And there are constructive, serious proposals for it. But they cannot be carried out as long as the United States and Britain block. That's crucial. A lot of crazy things going on in Iran and so on, but terrible. It's easy and makes you feel good to focus on how awful the other guy is. But it's helpful occasionally to think about oneself. Yeah, there's a lot we can do to prevent this. Is the United States going to attack? I kind of doubt it. One reason is that it's a well-known principle understood by everyone from schoolyard bullies to mafia guys, that you don't attack anybody who can fight back. And you only attack people who are defenseless. Everybody understands this. So Iraq, you could attack, is totally defenseless, destroyed by sanctions, no military, and so on. But Iran is not such a simple matter. They have, you can't invade, an invasion would be out of the question. And they have a deterrent capacity. Not just missiles, but other things. For example, they could cause enormous. I mean, the U.S. is having unbelievable problems in Iraq, and Iran could make them a lot worse. The Shiite regions of Iraq are very closely connected to Shiite Iran. A lot of the clerics come from there, the militias that are mostly running the south, some of them come from there. I mean, if Iran wants to become, to disrupt what's going on in Iraq, they have plenty of ways of doing it. And a lot more that they can, you know, talk about this later, so we can do it now. But Iran's just too dangerous to attack. And so I don't think they're going to do it. Furthermore, if you are going to attack a country, you don't announce it very loudly for 3 years in advance so that they can get ready for it, disperse their facilities, and so on. It would make a lot of sense. So my guess is, and we don't have it, you know, your guess is as good as mine, but my guess is that the saber rattling is for a different purpose. It's to try to intimidate Europeans, which turns out to be extremely easy. Intimidate Europeans, yeah. They'll pull out of their investments in Iran. And they've already started to do it, like petroleum and German companies and others. And that'll help isolate Iran more. And also it may drive, and I presume this is the purpose, it may drive the Iranian leadership to harsher measures. Well, that's bad for Iranian reformers, but it's good for the United States. Because if they impose harsher measures, there'll be more dissidents and tumult and so on. And that may help with what are pretty sure must be U.S. programs, probably British as well, ongoing right now to try to carry out subversion in Iran, you know, break it up, stir up ethnic animosity. And there's a lot of ways of making Iran very difficult to control. And if that can be done, maybe Iran can be weakened enough so that the Western powers would be willing to attack. I guess that's the goal. But I seem kind of unlikely that they'd be crazy enough to carry out bombing.
Could I
maybe
interject at this point? Because yeah. We do have many people wanting to ask questions. Well, please continue. Ask you all to stick to 2 minutes. I neglected to ask no questions. Please go ahead.
spoke quite a bit about the official doctrines and our failure very often, but the importance to challenge those doctrines. And a few times I think he compared the West to North Korea, but then he also threw in the contention that in North Korea, one's faith for actually taking them on will be really bleak, while in the West there is, you know, there could be little excuse for that other than cowardice. But I'm just wondering, is it a case that, especially in recent times, that the West, all the administrations in the West are just taking on a war on public dissent and have all but criminalized public dissent with legislations like the Patriot Act in the United States, anti-terrorist legislation in Europe, we have the Public Order Act here, that's consistently being used to criminalize trade union pickets, political protests, and so on. And I'm just wondering, do you have any kind of advice of how to go around this or take this on?
Ignore it.
Bravo!
Compared with what people deal with everywhere in the world, the kind of repression that we face is just minuscule. Yeah. It's deplorable. We should get rid of it. Governments shouldn't have the capacity to control. But we're just so lucky as compared with the rest of the world. That it makes sense.
I'm an activist of the anti-Mormon, so I completely agree with your thesis about imperial domination in all sorts of democracy. Latin America is probably the best example, where because the US is tied up in Iraq, actually you've seen quite the flowering of democracy or opening. And I suppose you've seen the torture scandals. So one of the big things that's reignited the debate around the war in Europe and in Ireland in particular is the issue of the torture flights, which I think it continues on from things like Abu Ghraib and that. But the main point, or the main question I want to ask you is around people power, because 3 years ago, people marched in the streets on February 15th, the biggest demonstration the world had ever seen before a war had started, unprecedented. But one of the questions people had coming out of that is the government didn't listen. Now, I actually think they did listen, and there've been the echoes of that demonstration have been, if you look at the crisis of Blair, you can also see it with Bush. But in December, I was a delegate to an international peace conference in London, which had US, Iraqi, and people from Britain, obviously. But from that, there was a call for another international demonstration on March the 18th. So I'd just like to hear what you think about, do mass demonstrations work, and would you endorse the call for people to come out to the March the 18th demonstration in Dublin?
Yeah, whether demonstrations goes way back, you know, forever. Demonstrations are not a point of principle, they're a tactic. And the question is a good tactic? You know, so with the tactic, yes, but its consequences are going to be. Well, you know, these tactics, if they're well done, do have influence, dual influence. For one thing, government's power systems can't ignore them. They may pretend they don't ignore them, but that's not true. In fact, I mentioned one striking example in Iraq. The mass demonstrations in Iraq simply could not be ignored by the U.S. and Britain, and they had to tolerate elections, you know, gritting their teeth. And the same is true of demonstrations in the West, and it can continue. But there's another significance to demonstrations, and I think that's the really important one. They inspire the activists, the people concerned, to go on and do the important work, which isn't showing up, you know, every year or two for a demonstration, but working constantly. If you want change, if you want serious change, it's not going to come by instant gratification. You got to work on it constantly. That's a lesson which has been forgotten in the privileged societies, but it's well known elsewhere, and it's well known in our own history. You want to achieve something like, you know, women's rights, labor rights, voting rights, decent health care, whatever it may be, in the war, you're going to have to work on it day after day, locally, regionally, all sorts of connected activities. And the demonstrations can be a way of kind of inspiring that work to continue. But if demonstrations are understood as something that you do when there's a call and then you go back to living your life, they'll be pretty much vacuous. Feeling that, I mean, whatever you think about the old Communist Party, think about whatever you like. There was one good thing about it. There was always somebody around to run the mimeograph machines and to do the regular work that had to be done, whatever it was. Now that's quite the same is true with labor organizing or anything else. It's got to go on. It's got to be a real commitment. Demonstrations are good if they inspire that commitment. They're harmful if they're a substitute for that commitment. But that's just something for us to think about. Thank you.
It just struck me when you were talking, Professor Chomsky, that the political character of the United States seems to be obsessed with security, and perhaps that's part of the national character, I don't know. And maybe coupled with the fact that not that many Americans actually travel outside the United States, a lot of people don't really have an understanding of different cultures, particularly the military, you know, when they go to different countries. And I just wonder how that has happened, since the United States is built, you know, at least very significantly, on immigrant populations. How did that come about? I mean,
what
would be your observation?
Well, first, I think you're correct, and it's a striking fact about American history. I'm going to go into it. It is very striking in popular literature, popular culture, and so on. There's a big element of fear, and it's been studied. There's good scholarship on it, but the fear is very interesting. It's usually fear of destruction by some massive force. From which, if you look at popular literature, standard themes since the early 19th century, we're going to be destroyed by some huge, powerful force, but at the last minute, you know, a brave high school student or somebody, you know, gets together in the woods, they defeat it or whatever. It's a theme that's nowadays it's in television and so on. And if you look more closely, it turns out that the vast enemy that's going to destroy us is almost always somebody that we're crushing under our jacket. So it's blacks, Indians, Native Americans, Chinese, even progressive writers like Jack London. I think Jack London was one of the most progressive writers. He wrote stories back around 1910 arguing that the United States should carry out bacteriological warfare to wipe out the whole population of China, because the Chinese are insidiously trying to take over the United States. That's what those little laundries are about. Chinese, you know, hundreds of millions of them are going to take us over and destroy us. That's right after the Boxer Rebellion and all the atrocities and so on. And yeah, that's a theme that does run through, and you can ask exactly why it's there. And partly, I think, your point about the insularity of the United States has to do with it. It's a very insular country. Like, most people don't know where France is. You know, I mean, I give you example after example. In fact, one interesting effect of 9/11, contrary to what's often reported, is that it made the country less insular. There was a significant, it led a lot of people to start thinking about the U.S. role in the world. And the education was in a horrible atrocity, but the effect was to open people's minds. And now there's much more concern. That's one of the reasons why there was a huge demonstration. But yeah, that's true. On the other hand, one also shouldn't exaggerate it. This fear is very carefully engendered. There are huge propaganda efforts to try to frighten people. And the more aggressive the country gets, the more it is consciously frightened. So, you know, during the Reagan years, this famous sit-ins of democracy promotion, there was just immense propaganda to terrify people. I mean, it's kind of comical if you look at it, but it was having an effect. It started off by fear about Libyans. Libyan hitmen were wandering around Washington planning to assassinate our leader, who was holed up in the White House surrounded by tanks, and miraculously he escaped. The United States was under threat of attack from the nutmeg capital of the world, Grenada. The British were building an air base, and maybe the Russians would locate it on a map and destroy us. We had to invade Grenada. Then, you may have forgotten, but in 1985, the brave cowboy in the White House declared a national emergency in the United States because of the threat to the security of the United States posed by the government of Nicaragua. You know, with a laugh and cry. And he went on to give speeches, passionate speeches, about how the Nicaraguan army was only 2 days away from Arlington, Texas, and everyone was supposed to tremble. Or you'd frighten back terrorists. And the tourist industry in Europe collapsed repeatedly through the 80s when Americans were afraid to go to Europe because there might be some Arab terrorist hiding behind a lampposts in Paris. And it was the same message. Reagan administration particularly had people terrified of crime, of drugs, you know, of welfare mothers driving in Cadillacs to welfare, you know, pick up or earn money and so on. And you gotta do that sort of thing when you're smashing people in the face. This is a period of in which the American population has really suffered. Into it now. It's the worst period in American economic history since 1980 to the present for the large majority of the population, and it continues. And when that's going on, yeah, you have to do something. And one of the ways to control people is frighten them. It's going on right now. I mean, the Bush administration, when it was the invasion of Iraq was pretty much announced in September 2002, and it was accompanied by a huge government media propaganda campaign. Next time we hear from Saddam Hussein, it'll be a mushroom cloud over New York, Condoleezza Rice, and on and on. And within a couple of weeks, the American population was driven off the international spectrum. You know, everyone hated Saddam. The United States is the only place where they feared him. Like, even in the countries near that he invaded, you know, Kuwait, Iran, people hated him, but they weren't afraid of him. I mean, what was he going to do? But in the United States, they genuinely feared him. And that continues, and it's stimulated. On the other hand, you know, the idea that the U.S. should lash out by force is not held by the population. That's elite, liberal elites as well. I gave some of the figures before, but just to finish it, a large majority of the U.S. population since about April 2003, right after the invasion, have taken the position that the United Nations ought to be responsible for, take over responsibility for security, economic reconstruction, political change in Iraq, and the U.S. should be subsidiary. That's been the public position since April 2003. No, you know, didn't even come up in public, in intellectual commentary, journals, media, and so on. Political parties going to talk about it. It's another comment about American democracy. In Spain, you may recall, in March 2004, the population voted out the government, and what they actually called for was not withdrawal of Spanish troops from Iraq, but withdrawal of Spanish troops unless they were under UN supervision. Okay, well, they would bitterly attack the United States and Britain for cowardice and appeasement, you know, not standing up to terror and so on. I couldn't find one comment anywhere that said that the Spanish voters were taking the position of the large majority of Americans. In fact, it had been their position for a year. There's a difference between the United States. Spain is no fantastic model of democracy, I'm not claiming that. But there's a difference between Spanish and U.S. democracy. It's true of Britain, too. In Spain, people knew what public opinion was. In the United States, they didn't. And in Spain, you could vote on the issue. In the United States, you can't. Okay, those are important things, and they have to do with the fear. You know, the fear is partly engendered, partly it's just not true. It's an elite attitude which turn into policy, but the public doesn't like them.
No, I'm going to interject again. Sorry, yeah. But we're very short on time. And as such, we can take only two more questions.
Being very brief, the first point is the environmental destruction of Iraq. Authorities have noted
that vast areas of Iraq were so poisoned by depleted uranium from weapons that they may have to be evacuated. They may not be fit for human habitation. And I'm concerned about what you think can be done about that. The second point is, America, for me, has been a pseudo-democracy for quite a long time. I think the seven states should have been allowed to secede, and the world would have been much better off. But given where we are now, that 80% of Americans want something that their government doesn't want, the two political parties don't even take an anti-war position. And Americans are working. Before the war, city councils all over America voted against the war. This vast opposition is there. It's building. The main obstacle seems to be people's awareness of what other people's opposition actually is in America. I know there's some ways that some states are trying to connect, say, with Venezuela to get oil. They're trying to make linkages with other countries as states. And I'm wondering, do you think that more autonomous state activity is a way that we can actually overcome this Bush dynasty? Or what other ways can we do?
First of all, we should remember, let me say again, that one of the easiest things to do is to blame the other guy for his faults. You know, makes you feel good, so on and so forth. Most of the problems you mentioned are problems all over Europe. They're real. And what can you do about it? Yeah, the kind of things you're mentioning. In fact, they are going on all over, and to the point we have to stress, the United States is very atomized. It's insular, and it's atomized. People don't know each other. I spend an awful lot of time giving talks all over the place. There's usually huge amounts. And they're usually done for some activist group that organizes it. And part of the point of the talk is that people in the same place will meet each other, literally, find out that, you know, we're not the only ones doing this in our little corner of the town. Somebody else in the other corner of the town is also doing it. And yeah, that has to be done. And there have been in the past ways of doing this, like unions. I mean, unions were not only important for working people and granting them rights, but they also enabled poor people to join together and in solidarity. You know, that's all the unions are about, solidarity, joining together to become a force that can change the policy. And part of the hysterical opposition to unions on the part of, you know, Thatcher, Reagan, and so on, and business all the time, is to try to undermine democracy. They are just a democratizing force, and they do overcome. They're one of the best ways of overcoming. This is why we live in more decent societies than we did 100 years ago. They're very weak, and there are big efforts to destroy them. Political parties barely function. There aren't participatory parties. Just elect a candidate producing organizations, essentially. So that means other measures have to be found. There's one the good reason why so much of activism in the United States is church-based. You know, when I give talks in the United States, it's mostly churches. And a lot of the things that go on are based in the churches. One reason is the churches exist. You know, they're one of the last institutions that actually exist. And so therefore, yes, things are based in them. And others have to be constructed. And the kinds of things you're talking about are quite real. Actually, this business with the oil is common. It's almost common. I mean, it's in my own city, Boston. There are a lot of poor, you know, it's a rich country, but there are a lot of very poor people, like Ireland, and they just can't get by. And with oil heating, it's cold in Boston over the winter. With heating prices going up, they just can't pay them. Well, a group of senators appealed to eight major oil companies to provide low-cost fuel over the winter to help poor people get by. And they got one response from Citgo, happens to be owned by the Venezuelan government. So they're providing cheap oil in Boston, South Bronx, and now a couple other places. And that makes people take notice. I mean, you read the newspapers, and it's all about this hideous dictator who's destroying democracy, and, you know, friendly with Cuba, all kind of horrible things. But, you know, if you're getting oil from them to heat your homes, it opens your mind. You know? that's happening. Things like what you mentioned can be continued. It's just really a matter of scale. I mean, there's no magic tricks to any of this. There are no techniques that somebody's going to discover that you haven't thought of before. It's the same techniques that have always been used in the past, except doing them.
Should we have one more question, then?
My question is about so-called Western elites. The question is, to what extent is the corporate media, such as The Guardian, The Irish Times, Irish Independent, complicit in Iraq's legal war as a result of its inaccurate portrayal of the case for war and the continuing conflict?
Well, I don't really read the Irish press enough to make a comment on it. And even the British press I sort of read sporadically, so I really don't like to comment on it. I mean, that's for you to decide. But I can make a guess. The U.S. press, and I don't think it's different elsewhere as far as, in fact, in the continent, it's often worse, German press and French press. But the war in Iraq is described in the manner that some high school newspaper would describe the local sports team. The framework of discussion is always, how well are we doing? Did the coach make a mistake? Should he have substituted another player? Can we do better next time? I mean, if I had the resources, somebody should go through the Russian press during the invasion of Afghanistan. And I bet it would be exactly the same. All about the torment of the Russian soldiers, and they're facing these jihadi terrorists, and they're trying to bring democracy to freedom, but they're not doing well because, can we do it better, and so on and so forth. I mean, I have never seen virtually never seen a departure from that framework in Western press. It's the way that most totalitarian states describe their own atrocities. Within that framework, you do get some criticism. But the framework itself is so totally distorted, that you really can't comment on it. And that's true in case after case. I mentioned the CNN on Iraq today. I'll mention another one. They had a pitiful story about what's going on in northwest Pakistan, where millions of people are facing death and hideous conditions over the winter. And a couple of reporters, bravely went up there to see what it's like. And it was talking about how far they are from any doctors, and how awful it is, and so on. What can we do about it? Well, here's something we could do. According to the Pakistani government, maybe they're lying, but according to the Pakistani government, there are a lot of doctors up there from Cuba. Cuba apparently sent a lot of doctors, which they do all over the world. And they're not like the doctors who come from the West. They go live in hideous conditions. They live with poor people. They live in the mountains, it's a lot of places. So one thing we could do to help Pakistan, assuming the Pakistani government isn't lying, is to help Cuba do something that Western powers won't do, and then help people, help people in real distress. That would be something we could do. But could that even be mentioned? You tell me whether it's mentioned in the Irish press. I can guess. But it's the kind of thing you just can't mention. And case after case is like that. The framework of discussion is so skewed that even extremely good reporting, and it does exist, is within a framework that just is imposing serious misimpressions. Kind of like, reporting, go back to the high school football team. The high school newspaper may be reporting accurately what's going on with the sports team, but you can't discuss it. I mean, that's not the way to describe events. So sure, they're part of it, and you should. In the United States, there's extensive analysis of media, very careful and well-documented media critique. There's some in Britain, very little anywhere